Tom P. Tom.
Help me open this meeting with a moment of silent meditation followed by the serenity prayer. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. My name is Tom Palmer and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I'm a little disappointed. I thought I was the speaker and John was the chairman. I've been telling Cornel I've been ready for my talk on humility for years, but he doesn't agree yet. I was a little like the Pope, you know, when he gave his first mass when he got to Italy. He was standing up and he was chanting and he was saying, Leon, Leon. And a little Catholic lady got up and turned it over and he said, oh, Noel, Noel. I've been doing that ever since I got sober, and that's why I keep going to these meetings. Probably one of the things that I believe in is the big book, and for Al-Anons, I think it's a marvelous thing. If you have husbands that are still drinking, that's a fantastic place to hide your money, because that's the last damn place you'll look for it. And sometimes I think at these meetings we conserve time by not reading a portion from chapter 5. Well, I damn near died from conserving time. And as a matter of fact, in Dexter, Michigan, about 13 years ago, I told a fellow by the name of Jack that I was tired of listening to that sheet and a half. I'd heard it 10 times, and let's get on with the meeting. And a week later, I had those leather straps on again. And Jack came in to buy me a carton of Cool, so if you don't mind, I will read that. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures have availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if He were sought. I thank you for giving me time to read that, because as I say, I was one who I never had enough sense to read the directions. I'm here as a Yankee. Johnny was saying something a little earlier, they don't let many Yankees. Well, I was processed down here. I went to treatment six times up north, and they finally sent me down to John Mooney in Statesboro. And they let me go home in 1980. I went down there in 73 and came back in 80. And Cornel used to point his finger at me in the beginning, you know, and say, "You can't think your way into sober living. You have to live your way into sober thinking." But the nicest part is we tried to learn how to be Southerners, and Guy W. of Metter one time tried to teach my wife Peggy to come up here. She wanted to come up to the fellowship, and she wanted to go and ask for time off, and Guy said, she said, "Well, I'm going to go ask for it." And he said, "No, you don't do that down here." He says, "You say, look here now." He says, I'm going to be needing 3 days next week, or I'm going to be here. And so they went through lessons on look a here. And she'd say, "Look a here." And she'd say, "No," he'd say, "it's look a here." She finally got it all down pat and went in one day and told her boss, she said, "Now look a here, I'm going to be gone next week." And he fired her. I'm still having trouble up north. I don't know if you've ever said hey to a Yankee, but they don't say hello, they say what? You got a great treat in for you tonight. Johnny H. is one of the finest fellows that I have ever heard. It was my first opportunity really to walk up to him tonight. And what I want to do tonight is, I've told Johnny that this gift is from you. So when he finishes talking through your applause, you can present this to him. And I've also asked him to close this meeting when he's through. So let me give you now Johnny H. from Lakewood, California.
Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee for allowing me the privilege of participating in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't think that there's any greater privilege that's ever been bestowed upon me in my life than the great privilege of participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, in any capacity that I'm allowed to participate in. So it's with great pleasure that I thank you for allowing me to participate in this fantastic weekend. I'm just sorry that my mother and father couldn't come. But Papa wanted me to tell you that he sends his love and he's going to get well and come back next year. So I bring you greetings from him. I'm extremely pleased to be here tonight, fully clothed and in my right mind. And I know that really doesn't do a lot for you, and I don't say it to do anything to you. I find out that the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 25 years ago right now, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God, as he expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. Now, if I don't get anything out of this deal at all, I can live with that all the way home. I'd like to be able to stand here tonight, or anywhere in the world that anybody would listen to, and tell you that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. God, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. Because I'm just as sure as I'm standing here that without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. You see, back far back as I could ever possibly remember, I've been some type of emotional left fielder. I've always been out there wandering around somewhere, wondering what's going on. I just always seemed to feel kind of strange. I just never felt like I was there, wherever it was. They were, but I wasn't. And they seemed to know something that I didn't know. And they seemed to have something that I didn't have. And you know who they are, don't you? They're the reason we're in here. And if somebody wanders up to you tonight after the meeting and says, who is them days he is talking about? You send them to Al-Anon. As far back as I could ever possibly remember, I was filled with that deal of not being a part of. And falling right behind that was a tremendous wall of anger inside of me. I carried this big wall of anger inside of me. And I'm always trying to figure out who was responsible for the way I felt. Because it was never my fault. It was his fault. And I had an excuse that I followed for a long time. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, 4 drunken uncles, 3 drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself way back there somewhere, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are the bad people. I don't belong around them, so I'm going to go out and find out where I belong. And I remember looking around, and I looked up one day, and my eyes fell upon my grandmother, who was a kindly old lady. She lived till she was 90 years old, my grandmother. My grandmother never drank, and I felt different. I was like my grandmother. Then all I was going to have to do was just go where my grandmother went, and I'd be okay. And so one Sunday, my grandmother said to me, I'm going to take you with me, Johnny. I left these people on a Sunday morning that I felt different and strange and irritable around and hated. I went over and I moved in and sat down in this room with a different room full of people, and I felt different and strange and irritable, and I hated all them too. And I didn't understand that. And then I did something sitting in that church a long time ago that I did most of my life. I remember sitting in that church. I'm different, and I'm strange, and I'm irritable, and I don't belong anywhere in the world. I'm consumed with this thing called anger, and I got a great big hole with the wind whistling through me. And I wait for this man to mount that rostrum that morning a long time ago to tell me why I felt that way. And even more important than that, I wanted to tell me what to do about it. I remember him looking down where I was sitting and said I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, you're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters, and I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. God, I felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in that church a long time ago that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving, and I didn't know what to do about that. Turned to walk outside the door of the church that day, my old man standing there drunk and hungover, and he reached over and tapped me on the head and said, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. There was a lot of things in life I didn't want to be, but my old man wasn't one of them because he was a drunk, and I hated him for it. You see, I lived in a house where there were 2 drunks working. And if you haven't lived in a nightmare like that, I'll explain it to you. In a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and dying and start kicking me around. He didn't do it to my brothers. He just did it to me. I can remember gone, terrified. He's out there somewhere. He's going to come in and get me. I know that. And some nights I'm so frightened I go to bed with a knife by me. And if he comes tonight, I'm going to stick him. He don't come those nights, thank God. And so I lay there in my terror. And I'm thinking about the things that are going on in my life. I'm thinking about my uncles who live in penitentiaries. I think about my aunts who live in houses on the other side of the tracks. I think about my grandfather who burns down barns. I think about my mother who beats up my old man who beats up my mother. I think about all those things. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. What causes all this stuff? And somewhere way back there in the middle of the night, it dawned upon me what the problem was. It's alcohol. They drink. They do those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world and have something and do something and be something. But what do you do if you're weird? I'll tell you what I did. I took a drink. It wasn't any big decision on my part. I just got in my old man's bootleg hoots and took a drink of alcohol. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down in there and just kind of tore the madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness, moved me into the gray fringes of the business of living, and installed in me some type of arrogance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people, and maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'll tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or use drugs no more, they don't work. That's as simple as I know how to put it. The sad part about my life is they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. I took a drink of alcohol. I thought to myself, my God, I'm like my old man. And from that day until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a little over 20 years later, I never took a drink of alcohol willingly in my life. I never took it because I liked the way it tasted. And I never took it because it was a sociably acceptable thing to do. I took it for one reason and one reason only. When it went down in there, it did something for me. That's why I drank. And I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge and stood in front of a judge and sentenced to the Hutchinson State Reform School. My mother came and took me out of that reform school and loaded me in a car and headed towards California. On the way to California, my mother said, kids, if we get to California, things are going to be different. They were. We left a one-room shack in Kansas. We went to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on the street corner and got drugged. I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. Tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground, having come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated it doing. It went down there, tore the madness from me, took me from there, and it stood me there and gave me that. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. I spent the next 3.5 years of my life in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month, my mother come to visit me. She said, I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different. Once a month, I went in front of a judge. He sent me to the Whittier State Reform School. Once a month, my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. Somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, my mother coming and going and making all those promises, At first, I didn't believe her. I don't want to believe her. I don't want to get all built up and get those dreams and get all kicked around anymore. Somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, I started to believe my mother. You see, I wanted so desperately to believe my mother. I wanted so desperately to believe that my problem, was in a little white house with a little white picket fence with a little old lady with a tray full of cookies and milk. You see, because if I could just have that, I'd be all right. That's what I wanted. We went in front of the judge one day, and he put me in a boys' home in the San Fernando Valley after 3.5 years. I got to that school, and the superintendent told me if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days, and God, I was good. 30 days came and went, and they loaded us on an old truck, and they brought us out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip. I remember like it was yesterday. They dropped us off in Hollywood, and I had to run to catch the old subway car to ride downtown L.A. in it. Had to get off the subway car and run down to 6th and Main to catch the old red car to ride out to Willowbrook, where I lived. And I got off the ground running 1.5 miles to my mother's house. I can remember like it was yesterday. Around the corner and down the streets all over now, going to be balloons and ceiling and cakes and welcome home and banners and all those little things that I've been thinking about. And I got to my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed, except me. I spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody that you care for them that used to tell me because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, Never reach your hand up out of the gutter, because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that, but there was something in here that said, no, that's not true. I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself. I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. I went on the street corner and got drunk. I come home next month and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It was always the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, and get drunk and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. And my second week in school was all right. I read books and studied and did all those things you're supposed to do. Kept busy. My third week in school, the madness hit, and I started to think. I started to think about showing up in the neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. My gang's wanting me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what would happen if I was to tell my gang I didn't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, or a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. I wonder what my gang would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head. I wanted to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. Just see, if you're like me, and you're nothing, and you're glued over here against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you that, you think about that. And finally the answer comes. It's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So you think about that. You think about sitting down and capping that bottle and pouring that stuff down and making that magic come all about you. And one day I did that. I've been thinking about that for 2 weeks. I throw a brick through the window, get me a bottle of wine. I sit down in the street corner with a gallon of stuff. I turn the seal. I poured that stuff down in me. I drank the whole gallon. And I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death, my magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. It wasn't very much longer after that, sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing was working. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of years of my life. It was never one or two, it was a combination of all of them. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem. I didn't stand up too often. That's not conducive for being a gangster. You have to look alert when you're out there doing them things. You can't run and say, stick them up and puke on somebody. Now, I don't know what they did in your neighborhood, but in my neighborhood, we didn't gather up and talk about puking. We gathered up and talked about being tough. And the reason we gathered up and talked about being tough is because we're scared to death. Somebody's going to find out we're scared to death. And you see, if you live like I lived out in the streets. You got to do a lot of things you don't want to do anyhow. Just to show that you belong out there when you know you don't belong out there anyhow. Can you imagine what the terrible dilemma is, and no matter wherever you are, you don't belong, and you got to try twice as hard just to let them keep you there, even though you know you never belong, no matter what you do? That's a dilemma I lived in all my life. That's all I did. And in my neighborhood, what I had to do just to prove that I'd be there, even though I didn't never belong there, just so they would let me stay there, I had to be worse than everybody else. I had to use more dope. I had to drink more whiskey. I had to pull more robberies. I had to hit more people in the head. I had to be twice as bad. I had to blah, 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 on and on and on. I had to be at the top of my field. You can put that in any category you want to. That's the way I lived. That's how sick I was. I didn't know I was sick. And when you live like I lived, out there in the streets, you go to jail a great deal. You're out there. They come along and say, get in. You just get in. Hell, the first time they locked me up, they raised my standards of living. So it wasn't any big deal for me to go rest for a few years. I used to think I got arrested. What really happened to me most of my life, they rescued me. If you left to my own dilemma, I'd have killed me out there. And I got arrested all the time. That's all I did. I just got arrested and went to jail. I even got arrested one time and sentenced to the United States Army. My Army career is very brief. I'm not eligible for the GI Bill of Rights, whatever that is. I didn't stay there. They had rules and no fences. You give me rules, but you better give me fences. I came back out of the Army and I resumed my gangster career, and for a while I flourished. I moved to the top of my field. I accumulated what society says is success. I had a big apartment building, lived in the top floor, I had a closet full of $300 suits, I had a big automobile parked in the garage, I had a pocket full of money. Had people coming around all hours of night and day begging a big man for a favor. Every once in a while a big man granted a favor. The only problem was that the big man couldn't leave his apartment, because every time he left his apartment, the police jumped on him and took him to jail. Every once in a while, I used to get real brave. I'd put on one of my new suits, I'd sneak down the back stairs, I'd get my big automobile, and I'd drive around the neighborhood. I'm driving up alongside of people in old beat-up pickup trucks, and I'm asking myself questions like this. Good God, what's the matter with me? Why can't I be like that guy? Why can't I be like my brother? Why can't I just go to work and have a wife and a couple of kids like everybody else? Good God, what's the matter with me? See, I had no way of knowing that time in my life. I was running out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for my dilemma. And the thing that kept me from going totally and permanently insane prior to coming to this fellowship was my ability to blame somebody other than me for my own actions. And the last thing I had left was God. God's fault, he don't like me. And every once in a while I hear that nay, it scares me half to death. They usually go, well, I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. Deal. I'll tell you how I feel about that. Next time you get hungry, go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. One comes squirting through the keyhole, you call me. Old Tom and I have been looking for a deal like that all our lives. 1951, I'm on my way to the penitentiary for the first time. And I'm laid in the old Los Angeles County jail. My mother come to visit me, and she screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of and died. I didn't know how to handle that very well. I handled like I handled most things. I got mad at it. 3 days later, I'm handcuffed between two detectives standing underneath a tree, and they're burying my baby brother. Now, I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I'm trying to cry, and I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth, and the reason I don't have them, but I don't think they're necessary. I went on to the penitentiary. I stayed there 4.5 years. I came out of there 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die at an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room. He says, you're going to end up here, hotshot. And I told him, not me, I'm different. I come waltzing out of that institution, bound determined. I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round of some of the better laughing academies in the country, interviewing psychiatrists. I used to talk to those guys. I'd sit there with my wraparound overcoat on. And they'd talk to me about my mother, and I'd talk to them about their mother, and they threw me out of the room. Then they introduced me to better living through electricity. You got any real hot shots that you know about, boy, you just give them some of that electroshock treatment. Boy, that'll straighten them right up. Just kind of takes all the fight out of you. I'll tell you what it does, though. 25 or 26 years later down the road, you won't plug any appliances in around your house. I have a tough time turning on light switches sometimes. What'll happen, I think. I remember my last session with the skull jockeys. It was in a nut house in Fort Worth, Texas. And they just reduced me to a state of childishness one more time. And they shuffled me in and set me down in this room. Behind this desk sat a man, and behind his desk was a wall full of plaques and degrees and things. He had things from everywhere, and I thought, he must know. God, he's been everywhere. This guy has to know. I remember sitting at that man's desk. I remember exactly how I felt. I felt exactly sitting at that man's desk the way I felt sitting at my grandmother's knee when I was a child in church. I was still different. I was still strange. I still didn't belong anywhere in the world, and I hated everything that moved. I still had that tremendous hole inside of me that I didn't understand. Only now I've got one more problem that's worse than all the rest of those problems put together. Now, those things that I used to put in me to make those problems go away, no longer make them go away. Now I can't get rid of me. Now I'm stuck with me as long as I'm awake. I can't get rid of the faces of the people I've harmed and the things that I've done. I'm in bad shape. And I'm sitting across the desk from this man. You know what he told me? He said, "Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problem." You know, as sick as I was, I knew that wasn't the problem. Sick as I was. See, my problem was, I was nothing. I've always been nothing. I came from nothing. I was nothing. I was going to be nothing. I used to put something in me. I became almost. See, to a nothing, almost is top of the world. That's like trying to tell a guy when the building fell down, the elevator was defective. The guy's trying to tell me the things that I put in my system that changes me from a nothing to an almost is a problem when I know the problem is I'm nothing. What that proved to me was, after being treated by the state of California and the federal government for 20 years of my life, how unique I was, that there wasn't anybody else on the face of the earth like me, and I went back to town to die. And almost 26 years ago right now, they laid me down in the bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow. They tied my left arm and my right leg down, and a medical doctor threw the foot in my bed and said, "Son, you're going to die. There's nothing we can do for you." I said, "Okay." All day passed and all night passed. The third day he came into my room. I had a terror grip me I've never known before since in my entire lifetime. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed. I was going to go to the penitentiary. I was going to come back out and start that rat race all over again. And God knows I don't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, "Oh, God, help me." Now, I thought for a long, long time there was nothing happened because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an A meeting down there." Little bird didn't come in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest. I didn't wander off into the tulip somewhere. I went to sleep for a little while. No, that's not really what happened. But what really happened was that in my life, the utterance of that prayer, this inch, that incident, I didn't become magnificent. Still left running around with the poison that just got knocked. I did. I remember since the 20 years, anything to me, attention didn't mean anything to me at all. It's the way I live. Win some, lose some. But when I walked up to the judge's courtroom that day, the judge changed his conversation from me to a room. He's sitting in the courtroom. What he said to her was the most damning piece of evidence about me and my life. He said to her, "If you care, child, you're far away from being allowed to live. These are a sight in society on deep, because in my power, he's never gone. In my way, never gone." And I'm walking out of the courtroom. See, that was my grandfather. He put into words what I'd spent a lifetime trying to hide from the world. What I really, really was in here. Not what I put up out there, but what I was in there. That's the thing that used to drive me crazy. I thought people were going to find out. And I'll tell you how small my world was. I thought that everybody who lived in the world was in that courtroom, and that the secret was out. They all know now. And so I ran off and hid in solitary confinement for the next 9 months of my life. That way I didn't have to look at anybody and let them know that I knew, that they knew. And that's the way I was when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the first Sunday in November 1959. And I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take any credit for staying here from that day to this day. Because if I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 24 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. You got to be careful what gets us sick people in here. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I don't ever forget this. I moved in and sat down in the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big gates, and I thought to myself, my God, I wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this guy sitting next to me, what is this? He said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Dope Fiends Anonymous or something, had a little ring of class about it, I didn't want to be. I didn't know what one was. I thought, well, I'll wait for these women to tell their racy stories. And they got up and threw me a curve. Because they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face. They sort of radiated something I didn't understand. And right away they run to start talking about God. And when I came here and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room. Because God was the reason I was. It wasn't my fault anymore. You understand? It's God's fault. But I kept coming back to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'd seen you. And seeing you, I had seen the miracle. I didn't know that either. I'd come to meetings, you'd sit there and talk about God. I'd walk out of the room, I'd see people with these dancing faces and smiling eyes and things. Every once in a while I'd grab one of them convicts and throw him up against the wall, and I'm thinking about you, and look in his eyes and say, you don't have it, and turn around and walk off. You get a lot of strange comments in those places when you start doing stuff like that. Now one Sunday long time ago, I got up, I don't know what Sunday it was. I don't remember my attitude being any different when I woke up that morning. I don't remember my air of arrogance being any different. I moved in and I sit down in my seat where I always sit. That little guy that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me something I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It'll make more sense to me tomorrow than anything I'll ever learn. He says, you don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever told me that. People have been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot, but they didn't tell me how to live without doing it. How do you live in a world that you don't belong to, that wants no part of you and you don't want any part of, and the only thing that makes that world bearable for an instant is something that you put inside of you? After the meeting, I ran up to this little guy, and I said to him, how do you learn how to live? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. You go home and get that book, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. I guess he's prayed real hard, that little fella. Because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that take place in my life. And my life is the only one I know anything about. It seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was different. I wasn't like you. And I prided myself in my differences. And the more prideful I became in my differences, the sicker I became. And the sicker I became, the more prideful I became. And it's an on-ending thing. The different, more different, the sicker. And the sicker, the more different. And on and on and on. And I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and only listen to your differences. I'd hear you say things like, I used to drink, I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I'd say, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. When I don't drink, all hell breaks loose. I didn't understand the craziness that went on inside of me because I was sober and I was nuts. And you were sober and wonderful. You just weren't drinking anymore. And I said, my, I know I'm not alcoholic. But I only look for differences. I don't know. The reason I was different, see, if you can stay different, you never have to change. Everybody else has to shape up. But you can stay different and not change. But every time I talked to one of you, you told me about that book. I remember one time a guy said in a meeting, I heard a guy say, you got to get active in A. I didn't know what active was. So a couple of days later, when nobody was around him, I went over to the secretary of this group. Now, I didn't want anybody seeing me talking to that AA secretary. Hell, heaven forbid anybody see me getting well. I mean, I prided myself in my sickness and my differences. I said to him, I hear you got to get active in AA. And he said, that's right. And in all my arrogance, I puffed myself up and I said to him, I would like to know what I can do in AA so nobody will know I'm a member. He said, what? I said, I'd like to know what I can do in AA so nobody will know I'm a member. He said, you really are sick, aren't you? I was dead serious. And I use the word dead very dearly because I was almost dead seriously. You see, what I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to be sober, I'm sure. I wanted to have what you had, but I wanted to live my own lifestyle. I wanted to be hip, slick, keen, and cool. I wanted to be a taker of things and an abuser of people, and I wanted to be sober too. You know what will happen to you if you stay in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 24 years? And you practice the principles of this program, recovery is outlined in this, well, they got this red book here, but it's close. Thought I had some unscheduled literature there for a moment. Somebody was going to shoot me from general service. But you know what will happen to you? You practice these principles of this program of recovery, the way it's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, one day at a time. Try to give this thing to anybody that wants it, whenever they want it, for the best of your ability. Make it the number one priority in your entire lifetime. You know what will happen to you? You become square. You know why I know that's true? My 21-year-old daughter called me a square not long ago. She said, Daddy, you're lame. I said, thank God I've made it. I damn near died out there hip. What happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is very simple. You talked to me about a book and a program of recovery. And to prove to you that I was different, that this thing wouldn't work for me, I went to the book Alcoholics Anonymous to work the program of recovery. To prove to you I was different, it wouldn't work for me. And I couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. No way could I admit that. Alcohol was the word out of crazy. That's what my old man was, and I wasn't like him. So I wrote that off. I couldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. I'd been a ward of the state of California for 19 years, and my life wasn't unmanageable. I couldn't even admit that I was nuts. I got papers to prove I'm nuts by some of the best nut doctors in the world. Nuts. Absolutely incurable, they say. I'd like to use a better word, but I don't know any better word than just plain nuts. But the thing that got me was the fourth step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous called inventory. It's the thing that stopped me because, you see, I couldn't do the first three because I was too sick. But I could take a pencil and a paper and write down the things that I was writing about. I don't know what I wrote to it. It's like I was knocked all that stuff in and out of me. And I got up and I went around the corner and I sat down with a man. I spent 3.5 hours telling him about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And somewhere during that 3.5 hour period of session with that man, I heard me say to him that I was an alcoholic. Prior to that, I couldn't get the word out of my mouth. It stopped and came that thing. With the utterance of that word, and if that surrender, so be it. There came freedom inside of me that I carry with me to this very instant. The fact that I am, and I know what's wrong with me, and I've got a solution, and I live in the solution, that I'm an alcoholic. And then there's other things I had to do while I was confined. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was confined in an institution for a year and a half. It's the greatest blessing, but God knew all that. God's timing is perfect, you know. See, I was too sick to come to you out here. I couldn't have made it. I was too sick. I was too insane. I was too different. I'd lived too different too long in my lifestyle to come here. So what had to happen to me, I was like an insane, wild creature that you and the ever mercy of God working through your healing hands had to gentle and soothe and nourish and teach. Because you not only taught me about a program for living, you gentled me and you took the insanity out of me, and the anger was whipped down to mere pieces of nothingness, and you cleansed out my insides. And then you people came into my life. Along about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It was kind of the trigger that made it go. And I'm cussing this little dentist one day, and I said to him, whatever I was saying. He said, John, if you ever get out of here, what are you going to do? And I told him. He says, you'll never make it. And I said, why not? He said, the minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from. I said, what's the matter with my mouth? He says, nothing. You just open it every now and then. And then he told me a very wise thing. He asked me, he said, do you know what cussing is? And I said, no, what is it? He said, it's a crutch for conversational cripples. And I heard me say to this man, oh, what am I supposed to do about that? He says, if you're serious, I'll help you. So he and three of his little friends set me in a room for a period of time. And over a period of time, they word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. These little men corrected me, and then they stood my wrath while they corrected me. You see, it takes a great deal of love to correct somebody. That's all love is correction. Love isn't he-he-he and putting up with nonsense. Love is correction. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest example of that I know of anywhere in the world. We don't put up with unacceptable behavior here. You don't do that because unacceptable behavior has a way of weeding itself out of our fellowship. And these little guys love me. I came out of that penitentiary 22 and a half years ago. I went home to see my mother. She fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch, said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. Took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud, and I tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. Now, she don't stay sober all the time, but that really isn't any of my business. I learned the greatest lesson in life from my little mother. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. Where would I get any power? The book tells me that I'm powerless, that I have a daily reprieve from this thing called alcoholism, and that's only contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. What that tells me is this, that this is all I got right now. Right now I've got. Right now I can't even guarantee you that I'm going to get home from this thing. I can't guarantee that. I got right now. And right now, right this moment, is the greatest moment I've ever lived in my life. But I'm just as sure as I'm standing here that the best moment of my life and the best day of my life hasn't arrived yet. I'm sure of that. And the reason I'm sure of that is because the book Alcoholics Anonymous makes me a promise. That if I actions of this program of recovery the way it's outlined in this book, that I will grow along spiritual lines. That's the promise my book makes me. And I understand that. Maybe that's why I stay here, because looking back on my life, from the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to where it stands today, I do know that there has to be some type of growth in there for me to call up out of that slime that I was in and come here. And the last year of my life had been one of the greatest awakening years of my life. The last year. I have heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the last year has been a great teacher of things. I've had a lot of things happen. I can't come here and tell you that I wandered into AA and got wonderful, and I came out of that penitentiary, I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about work, and some guy gave me a job in the oil field. I went down and report to work one day, and the guy said, what's your Social Security card number? I said, what? Why not? I don't have one. He said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 30. He took me down and got me a Social Security card. Then I went to work, and I didn't know nothing. See, I know all about living in an institution. I know about ringing them bells and marching this way and ringing a bell and marching that way and sitting down and eating real quick and running out the door. Having somebody tell you what to do, when to do, and how to do, it's almost like a real strong marriage. You know what I mean? Yeah, I know all about that. I didn't know nothing about living out here. This is my problem. I don't know how to live about people. I don't like people. Don't want to be around them. And I don't know anything about, don't know what they do. So I used to watch them. We used to stop off from the job in this market, and I used to go in there and get a pack of cigarettes, and I'd watch the people. And I'd see them. They'd have their kids in those baskets, you know, little kids, and push them around there. And by this time, my wife had came back and brought my little girl, so I remember I got a paycheck. God, first paycheck I ever got. I ran home and got the wife, let's go to the market. She said, we don't need anyhow. We went down to the market, and I put her in this basket. I put her around, I said, load it up. She, you know how they do it? They load it. And we finally got, and I got back to the house, and I thought I'd really done something. And I went to get some money to get a haircut, and somebody stole her purse. Now, if you want to hear somebody scream, you ought to hear a thief when they get stolen from. Why, I ranted and raved and jumped up and down and hollered and hooped. And I'll tell you, if I could have found that guy, you'd have a different speaker tonight. When I got through, she said, you all done? I said, yep. She said, now you know how it feels. You know what? I went back to work that very night, and I ain't missed no paycheck from that day to this day. None whatsoever. They ain't stole none from me either. So I know all about that. I know what it's like to be on the other end. And even though it's frustrating, it's a lot better to be on that end than on the other end, because I've been on both sides. I know what it's like to be a taker. I know what it's like to be tooken. I'd rather be tooken than be a taker. And the reason I tell you that, because when I was a taker, I couldn't stay sober and couldn't stay out of trouble. Just couldn't do that. I got to tell you this, because something happened into my marriage. The woman I was married to and the mother of my children, something happened to her. Happened to her right before my eyes. I didn't recognize it then because I was too enraptured by what I was doing going to meetings. She didn't find it necessary to go to a program of recovery. She thought it was all right for me to be sober. And then that became irritating because I would go to meetings and she wouldn't. And she tried to get me not to go. And she'd make me feel guilty to go to meetings. You'd call. I'll say, I come. I'd turn around and she'd say, don't you ever think of anybody but yourself. You're either working or you're going to the meeting. God, I felt guilty. Then you'd call and I'd say, I can't come. Then I'd feel guilty because I turned you down and you gave me life and I didn't know what. I was in a terrible dilemma. I couldn't live that way very much longer. I asked God for some help in that situation. I said, I don't understand this. One night I was out on the rig working. A little while later, she took her own life. I didn't handle that very well. Got angry at it. Set meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, reverted to what I always was. Snarling, angry, egotistical, hurt little boy, crying because they'd taken away all his toys and his props. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one night where my sponsor was talking. I think I was going to tell him goodbye. But I got to him and he's talking, you know what he talked about? He talked about his wife and his home and his jobs and his kids. After the meeting, I went up to talk to him because that's what I was supposed to do. I couldn't get near him because there was a crowd of people around him. I started trying to walk outside the door, and he busted away from the crowd. He came and got me, put his arms around me, looked at me, and he said, Johnny, he said, I guess God must love you a great deal. I didn't feel like God loved me very much, and I told him so. He says, yeah, he never gives us any more we can handle, and those who got the biggest load surely got to be the blessed. I promptly told him I didn't want to be blessed no more either. And then he hit me with something I don't understand. I still don't understand it. He said, remember this, my friend. He gives big crosses to big horses. He gives little crosses to guys named John. I went home that night and I got down on my knees in that little bit, two-bit room that I lived in. And I said something like this, God, relieve me from the bondage of self, that I may be witness to those who see of your undying mercy and love, amen. And I got up off my knees and it seemed like to me that I started walking out the end of the tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel. A little while later, I'm at a 4th of July picnic, a picnic, and I'm walking to this picnic, and a little blue-eyed angel walked up and gave me a piece of chicken. I want you to know that's the most expensive piece of chicken I've ever eaten in my life. But it's also the most rewarding meal I've ever eaten, because Dottie brought something into my life that's never been there. See, in our home, we share a program of recovery. She's recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and so am I. We ain't recovering from alcohol. We're recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, because alcohol ain't the enemy. I'm the enemy. She brought love into my house I don't know about. She raised those two kids, and they're her kids, they ain't mine. I'm sure of two things as I'm standing here before tonight, and I learned these from my father. That everything in life that's necessary for my fulfillment in life is going to be given to me. I know that just as well as I'm standing here. Everything that would hinder my fulfillment in life will be removed from me through no effort of my own. The only requirement that I have to do is practice the principles of this program, recovery, try to give it to anybody who wants it. I know that. You know the kid, that kid I was never supposed to see? I raised her. Not only raised her, she got a sister, 21 years old, raised her too. Not very long ago, 5 years ago, phone rang. I went down to the hospital and sit in the waiting room with her husband while she had my first grandson. And I stood in the window and watched my son-in-law wash that little baby boy down, and I'm crying. And as I'm standing there, there's a tug on my sleeve, and I don't understand, and I turn around, and there lays my daughter on that gurney. They just brought her out of the operating room. And she looked up at me, she got great big brown eyes, and she said, Daddy, what do you think of your grandson? I said, you're fine, honey. You know Jim did a good job. And she's got a child, too. Yeah, I know that. Dottie and I got a little deal going in our house. See, we don't know nothing about raising kids. We treat them like drunks. Don't know nothing about what I know about raising kids. They don't got no billboards out there that say this is the way you raise kids. And they didn't have any child psychology books in Folsom State Prison. So we just treat them like drunks. You know, they turned out fine. Just fine. Funny, isn't it? Don't make no special deal out of it. One night, Karen came by with this little boy, Jim. He's about 2 or 3 when they're just starting to move. You know how they move? And they're quick. She had to go to a high school reunion, and she said to me, Dottie was going to a meeting, she's treasure or something. She said, Daddy, I ain't no babysitter. And I said, I'll take care of him. She said, can you? And I said, sure. Took care of you, didn't I? She said, uh-uh. But anyhow, she left, and me and little Jim ran for a while, and he ran me till I couldn't run no more. And I got up in the bed and turned the television set on. Then he chased the dogs till they couldn't run no more, and they jumped up in bed and started watching. Then he laid down on the floor and kicked himself to sleep. And I went over and I picked him up. And he just said, I love that little kid. And I put him on my chest. And I'm hugging him. And it dawned upon me, Well, I got my grandson on my chest, that little boy that I loved to pieces, that little boy. What's going on here? All the experts, the so-called experts of life, said I had never supposed to see this kid's mama. The so-called experts. I not only got to see his mama, I got to raise her. I not only got to raise her, I raised her good enough where she let me take care of her little boy. And I start to cry. And they find me like that when they come in from this reunion. I'm crying. My kid don't think nothing about me crying. He just patted me on the head and picked the little boy up and left. They think that's a natural state for me to just look at him and cry. He thinks, you know what he does? I pick him up and hug him and I cry. You know what he does? He pats me on the back and says, okay, Papa. Oh, what great blessings people like me have been given. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you. I just love it. I'd like to tell you a couple of stories. The reason I like to tell you these stories, I like the way I tell them. And they're so meaningful to me because they're what Alcoholics Anonymous is, because so many times, some of us egotists in Alcoholics Anonymous become enraptured by our own magnificence, and we get to thinking that we have done something here, that we have worked and studied and did these things, and this is what we have accomplished, these things, and nothing could be further from the truth. You see, I live this certain way, and what's happened to me is a type of an evolutionary process. That what you see that has evolved out of the slime is what you see standing before you tonight is a direct result of just trying to practice the principles of this program of recovery. And every once in a while, a few years ago, they allowed me to go to a meeting in San Jose up in Northern California. And they invited me to this meeting, and it's a bunch of these kids and started this meeting, and they had rented this great big old hall. It's about half this big, and they had loaded up with all these kids. They brought all these kids from these drug recovery houses out of there, and they're all out of there. And I walk in, and I got a suit of clothes on. I'm standing over there in the corner with a cup of coffee, and some little kid wandered up to me, and the kid was hip. Well, he was. He was so hip, the balls of his feet tickled when he jumped up there. You know how they come up there. Hey, baby, he said to me, and I said, yeah. He says, are you Johnny Harris? And I says, yes, I am. He says, you don't look like him. I says, what does he look like? He said, well, you don't understand, man. Over here at this place where I'm at, they've been playing me your tape for 4 or 5 months. You know, you did all them things and did all that stuff. He said, yeah. And I said, well, if I had long hair and a beard and talked out of the corner of my mouth, used mother every other word, would that fit it? He said, yay. I says, you don't understand, young man. I live by a program that's spiritual in nature and practices the way of life evolves you out of that garbage. He said, the hell you say? Turn and walk off. I don't know. A few months later, I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a place called Reno, Nevada. And it's Saturday night, I walk into that auditorium and I walk up front and get me a cup of coffee. I look over in the front row, there sits that kid. Only it ain't the same kid no more. He got his beard shaved off and his hair's cut down nice. He's got a new pair of pants on, a nice clean shirt. He stands up and says, and I walk over there, he puts his arms around me, he gives me a little kiss on the cheek. He said to me, I just come over here to tell you that I live by the same spiritual program that you do. I think how easy it would have been for me to kill him in San Jose. I could have killed him with just a couple words. I could have got down with him. You ever notice that? When they want you out on the streets, they say to you, let's go get down. How come ain't nobody ever comes, let's go get up? You want me to tell you why? Because ain't nobody down wants you up. As long as you're up and they're down, you're a testimony to the lie that they're living. It's held true in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're unhappy here in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you ain't happy, joyous, and free, that ain't nobody's fault but yours. That's true. Because there ain't nobody got no special rights here. We all got the same program of recovery. We all got the same problem. We all got the same answer. We all live in the same solution. And if you ain't happy, joyous, and free in every area of your life, it ain't because You ain't up, it's because you're down. And if you're down, you don't want nobody up. I used to sit in these Alcoholics Anonymous and say, who do them people think they are being happy? Isn't that silly? Sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, making fun of folks who are happy. I remember I went to a meeting one night with a kid, an old man sober 20-some years, got up at a podium and he said, he's one of them wonderful people. I drink more whiskey than you young folks ever had. I'm happy and sober. Some kid got up to the podium right after him and said, old man, if you hadn't drank so much of that whiskey, if you hadn't spilled so much of it, you might have got here a little sooner. He said, if you think you're happy and joyous and free, you better tell your face because it don't seem to recognize it. This is a fantastic way of life, Alcoholics Anonymous. It set me free, it set me soul. Now everybody knows me, knows I love to play golf. I just love to play golf, that's all. A few years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a country club. One Wednesday, I'm out there playing golf with some doctors. And I'm walking down the fairway, I got a short sleeve shirt on my arms, I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. Crosses with little X's on them. It's just real conversation pieces in the coffee shop. You know? Particularly when he asked me what that panther is with no sight in him there. And this doctor said to me, he said, gee, Johnny, you have big forearms. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, did you ever play baseball? I said, every time I went to jail. He said, oh, you've never been in jail. And I never told him any different because that really isn't my deal. And I'm kind of glad of that because I've learned to love this little man a great deal and play a lot of golf with him. And he told me a story over a period of years that's worse than mine. He told me a story of a little Jewish orphan in the Bronx who worked and studied and sacrificed and did without and took himself out of the orphanage. And he saved and he studied and he sacrificed and he did without and he put himself through school. And he saved and he studied and he sacrificed. He put himself through medical school and become a doctor and he did without. Then he saved and he studied and he sacrificed. He joined the country club and he plays golf on Wednesday and that's his deal. I have no way of telling that little man. I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the streets, in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses, using and abusing people. And I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. You know why? He wouldn't believe me. That's society's code. You got to work and study and sacrifice and succeed. Nope. When I came here, they told me my sobriety was a gift from God. Being the type of person I was, I asked them, would I give God back? I didn't want to owe God nothing. They said to me, what I did with my sobriety would be my gift to God. I thought about that a great deal. My sobriety is the most priceless thing that I possess. I do nothing to put it in jeopardy. I live no way contrary to its teaching. I treasure it above all things. I love it to pieces. If what I do with my sobriety is my gift back to my loving Father God, I would live and pray and hope for one thing and one thing only for long to live. I would only love and pray that my loving Father God would be as pleased with my gift to Him today as I've been with His for 24 years. Thank you. If you'll all stand and join hands, we'll close our meeting in a normal way. And I'd like to ask my current cell partner to lead us in the Lord's Prayer. Dottie. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power,